Robert Kaplan for 3 decades reported on foreign affairs for The Atlantic. He was a member of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board and the Chief of Naval Operations Executive Panel. Foreign Policy twice named him one of the world's top 100 global thinkers. He is the author of 23 books. The latest is Wasteland, A World in Permanent Crisis. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Robert Kaplan to the roundtable once again. Thank you so much for being back. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
It's great to be back as well.
Give us a sense of this exploration of a world, as you say, in constant crisis. And I'm just interested in what lined up so that you wanted to take a look at where we are in this particular way.
Yes, the subtitle is A World in Permanent Crisis. I did not say an anarchy or anything like that. I said crisis. And 3 things lined up for me. First, I saw that as technology was shrinking geography and bringing us on all continents into closer, more claustrophobic proximity, we were repeating a sort of exercise of the Weimar Republic, which loosely governed Germany, a sprawling Germany. It was sort of an empire without an emperor. It was in constant crisis, and it existed from 1919 to 1933. So I saw the world as one big Weimar Republic in one sense. In another sense, I see all 3 great powers in some stage of decline. The United States, China, and of course, Russia. And the third thing was, I saw how urbanization and social media were changing the way people perceived things, and they were making geopolitics more intense, more intensely felt, so that it was a world of where, as one person I quote in the book, where the very finite or limited size of the Earth is a force for instability.
One of the things that I found fascinating about the book is that I think many of us feel this helplessness and a sense that we're slipping into an abyss. And while many say, okay, I have to look at other things, otherwise I'm just going to grind to a halt. But you keep bringing us to this point of why we should persevere, of why we should at least have some hope as to why this is all so important.
Yes, it's because none of us could know the outcome in advance. People say things like, you're on the wrong side of history. How do they know? They don't know the outcome of history. The present is all they know. So because we cannot know the outcome in advance, we have no choice but to keep struggling for a better world. And I anchor that at the very end of the book with a renewed call for liberalism. And I mean historic classical liberalism, which is, there was a great saying that a liberal is never sure he is right. He's always in uncertainty and therefore always willing to listen to other points of view. And to me, liberalism is ultimately about the individual, that what makes Western civilization unique and worth defending is its concern for the individual above the crowd. And that's what I come down to at the end of this admittedly pessimistic, long, essayistic book.
You say one of the opening contentions that you make is that we are living through the equivalent of a second Weimar Republic. How so?
Well, as I said, the Weimar Republic ended badly with gloom and doom with Hitler. I say early on that is not the fate of the world we live in for a whole number of reasons. In fact, Weimar could have survived. It could have prospered. It did not have to go south so suddenly with the ascension of Hitler. You know, had there not been the inflation in the early years of the Weimar Republic and the depression in the later years, Weimar might have succeeded. But what makes Weimar comparable to our world is that it was in constant crisis. The German leaders at the end of World War I devised the constitution in the Thuringian town of Weimar, which is why it's called the Weimar Republic. They devised the constitution where they could never repeat another autocrat like the Kaiser or like Otto von Bismarck before him. And they went too far in the other direction. You know, they learned a lesson too much, so to speak, so that nobody really had the requisite control. And therefore, there was a lack of order in the Weimar Republic, even as the arts and literature flourished during that period.
Robert Kaplan is our guest. The name of the new book is Wasteland. You look at where we are now, and of course, you are talking about the United States and talking about the great powers. What is it, and how did we get to not just our authoritarianism, but this global state of authority?
Well, I think that how did we get here? I think the problem in the world is that the empires have left, the monarchs have left, or they've become constitutional monarchs. And all that is to the good in a way, but it left an emptiness of authority. And what that led to is a sort of fear of anarchy, and that in turn led to new autocrats here and there coming into being. I can say right up front that while President Trump has declared a new golden age, I think he's really an instrument of America's continued decline. But that decline is going on at a slower rate and is more nuanced than what I see as the decline of China and certainly the decline of Russia, which is the most pronounced.
So looking at Beijing and Moscow as you say, these dangerous periods for political systems and being a late-stage autocracy. So where do we stand in that, and are we even equipped to deal with our own country, much less dealing with these other two superpowers?
Well, if you look at the end of World War II, the United States contained 50% of the world's manufacturing capacity. That's because all the other major powers had their infrastructure bombed and destroyed during the war, and the war was not fought on American soil in the continental 48 states at the time. We strode over the world like a colossus, as the cliche goes. And it took the rest of the world a long time to catch up, but catch up it has. America now constitutes, instead of 50% of world manufacturing capacity, only 16% of world manufacturing capacity. Also, we have a $36 trillion debt, which costs us close to $1 trillion a year to service. And this is how empires weaken and ultimately collapse, because of convoluted, complex economic reasons. This has been the history of empires for all time. And since the end of World War II, since 1945, we have been, in functional terms, an empire, a world empire.
You write in the book, we believe we have morally progressed in our values with an unprecedented emphasis on human rights and environment. But this says little about the stability of a global system beset by clashing interests. It's hard to find hope in that.
Here's how I would put it. We now have a global system. Those were the words you used and which I use in the book. Before, we never had a global system. We're close enough. We're joined enough. So although we don't have global governance, we do have a global system where events in China, events in Japan, events in Russia, in the Middle East can directly affect us, and we can affect them to a degree, to a claustrophobic degree that never existed before. So we are a system, and this system is beset by clashing interests. And all the concerns of the elites about human rights, about the mass sufferings in Sudan and Ethiopia and other places due to war, you know, they don't affect the decisions of the great powers very much. And this is a tragedy, but this is what I see.
Just in the last several days of a back and forth from the White House on Putin and Russia and the war with Ukraine, I mean, it's hard to know what the feelings of our president, what those feelings are, much less a policy towards Russia and then, of course, China.
Look, American foreign policy is determined by two things. One thing everybody knows about, which is the instincts and the tendency of the president. But the other thing that they don't know about is we have a vast bureaucracy managing the world. Deputy Assistant Secretaries of State and Defense, Assistant Secretaries of State and Defense, Under Secretaries of State and Defense, and on it goes. And these are all important, talented people who deal with crises on 180 countries on any given day. And this is very important. You know, the bureaucracy has been derided as the deep state. I know a lot of people in the deep state, and they're the most qualified, competent, well, emotionally adjusted people that I know. And with the ascension, the coming back to power of Trump, he is, you know, his goal, at least, is to eviscerate the deep state, to get rid of a number of these people and to appoint people to run bureaucracies with either without any competence or who have been out to destroy these bureaucracies in the past. So in that sense, it leads to a silent weakening of American power.
To give us an idea of the differences when you talk about that American power and the weakening, how things in your, and obviously no one has a crystal ball, but how do you believe things would have been different had either the Biden administration been able to continue or that Kamala Harris was elected president of the United States?
Well, as I say in the book, history is not just great impersonal forces. It's not just geography and economics and trade routes. It's contingencies. It's Shakespearean contingencies. It's who's elected. You know, as I said earlier, you know, Weimar could have gone in many different directions. It did not have to end up with Hitler at all. You know, and I say Shakespearean because Shakespeare dealt with this, with human emotion, clashing interests of individuals. And I think there would have been, I think we've just had a turning point of sorts with the election. I don't know how it will end up. You know, I want to be at least optimistic. I do know that Kamala Harris would have appointed as Secretary of State William Burns, the former head of the CIA, who's one of the most brilliant, well-adjusted, wise thinkers in Washington, someone who harks back to the great wise men who erected the post-Cold War order in the 1950s. He would have been a great Secretary of State. But Trump was elected, and he's appointed a senator, Marco Rubio, who's competent, but has no really stable worldview. His opinions have changed according to the politics over the years. And you know, he's nothing compared to William Burns. I say this because this is an example of how individuals make history and they make policy.
So, I mean, we're at the beginning of the administration, and we still there's a lot that we don't know, right? I mean, I think that's one of the
Yes.
things that's so troubling slash fascinating about this is that the there's a lot of rhetoric, there's a lot of red meat that's being thrown out, but as to what it actually means and what's actually going to be done and what actually can be done, we don't know that yet.
Yes. Look, Trump is hard to analyze because he, you know, he switch, you know, he has no well-formed, deep, articulated worldview. He tends to go from emotion to emotion with some tendencies. He's trying to resurrect an imperial America, but not an imperial America from the Cold War days, where I said before we've been an empire since 1945, but from a much older period of time. You know, he wants to, but keep in mind that when Trump says things like, I want to conquer Greenland or I want to take back Panama, this is how he talks. His normal tendency is to exaggerate. What he really might mean is he wants the Danes to pay more for Greenland's defense, to guard the submarine lanes on eastern Greenland where the Russian fleet comes out of. He wants the Panamanians to reduce the cost that they charge our ships coming through the canal. That's probably what he really means. But this is all small-time stuff. I mean, what it costs the United States to send ships through the canal, etc., is minuscule compared to our greater defense burdens. So, as I said, it's hard to analyze Trump because he go, you know, it's a lot of emotion and very little 4 steps ahead of the game analysis.
But so much of what he complains about, and so much of where, especially with foreign policy, take Panama for an example, about versus China, of take the United States and what they're paying versus what China is paying. That seems to regularly be something. What does that mean for relations with China and understanding China and even knowing the real threat there?
Well, you put your finger on it. Probably the most consequential aspect of the Trump administration's policy is going to be how it deals with China. In the book, I write that while financial markets have impressively priced in the wars in Ukraine, in Gaza, so that it doesn't really make a difference on people's retirement accounts. A high-end, a technologically speaking, high-end war in the Western Pacific over Taiwan, the South China Sea, would devastate world financial markets, would devastate retirement accounts and people's life savings. You're really playing with fire there. And the Biden administration handled China very well, actually. They made sure not to get into a military conflict with it, but at the same time, they strengthened our alliances. They brought Australia closer to the United States by agreeing to supply Australia with the technology for nuclear-powered submarines. They fixed up a trade war between South Korea and Japan in order to get both those countries to focus on China as part of the U.S. alliance. The Biden administration really wrote the textbook on how to deal with China from by you know w without making concessions, but also without threatening any kind of conflict. And so how Trump deals with China is going to be very critical. Tariffs have led to wars. You know, a world of tariffs is a world where the chance of war is greater, not lesser. And so I'm very worried about this.
I promise I'm not leading the jury here, but I am curious as to what you make of an electorate who looks at the choices and picks what they pick.
The way I explain it is that the United States was a great functioning mass democracy in the print and typewriter age, which lasted up through, like, you know, the late 20th century or so. And because the print and typewriter age was about moderation, it was about, you know, it was about professional journalism where things were explained in detail, and it strengthened the center, moderation. It made people center left or center right. But social media, the digital video era, has basically driven people to the extremes, you know, because it rewards emotion and passion is the enemy of analysis. So you have two warring sides who basically voted in this election, and one side got more votes than the other, but the country is still divided. That's part of the instrument of American decline that I see.
Robert Kaplan is the best-selling author of The Revenge of Geography. His latest book is Wasteland, A World in Permanent Crisis. It is published by Random House. Robert Kaplan, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Wasteland, A World in Permanent Crisis. It's published by Random House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.